So anyway, as Fair said, I want to talk about non-Fermi liquid behavior, and I want to specialize on uranium-based systems. And so Fair's asked me to give some introductory remarks, so I'm afraid this is probably a little bit more pedestrian than is appropriate for this audience, but at least it will set forth some terminology that I'll make use of in this talk. And what I'd like to do is concentrate on two things: some recent experiments on the M uranium plating 3 system, where M can be yttrium or scandium, and this was actually the first F electron system found to exhibit non-Fermi liquid behavior. And both of these systems have non-Fermi liquid behavior near a spin glass quantum critical point. And these systems, I think, are especially interesting because they allow one to study the interplay between the Kondo effect, a disorder, and antiferromagnetic interactions. And, you know, this whole thing started back in the early 90s, but recently we've done some neutron scattering work with Peng Cheng Dai at,
the cosmos.
I thought we set that to an hour. What happened?
I'm going to slide show on the bottom.
Yeah. Oh, good idea. I told you this was my first PowerPoint. Oh, I thought that looked strange. Okay, so and recently we found that this system near the quantum critical point exhibits mega over T scaling of the imaginary dynamical susceptibility. So I think this is the third example where this is found, and in this case it seems to be associated with this spin glass vanishing of the spin glass transition. And then I want to talk about some recent experiments on rhenium dope, uranium, ruthenium 2, silicon 2. And again, I'm not going to talk about hidden order. I just wanted to mention that this is probably one of the most interesting aspects of this parent compound, uranium, ruthenium 2, silicon 2. What we've been interested in is studying what happens near a ferromagnetic quantum critical point when you make this substitution, where you can actually generate a ferromagnetic phase that appears to be itinerant in nature. So anyway, that's what I want to do. And let's see now, how do I do this?
Ryan, is
yeah.
The cubic from the doping range that you're looking at?
Yes. Yeah. Oh no, not uranium. Yeah, that one's cubic. That's all cubic. Yeah, so in principle, the stage would be set for a quadrupolar Kondo effect, although we've never been able to establish that exists. Okay, so let me just make some remarks. So we're going to talk about intermetallic compounds containing a sublattice of uranium ions, which can be ordered or, as shown here, are not ordered. And as you know, uranium ions carry magnetic moments, and these are associated with a partially filled 5F electron shell. And when you do measurements, you can actually obtain results that are consistent with moments that are derived from Hund's rules, where you maximize the spin, then maximize the angular momentum subject to the Pauli principle, and then the total angular momentum is just equal to L minus S for less than a half-filled shell. And then once you know J, you can compute the degeneracy and the Lande G factor, and then the magnetic moment, and that actually is more or less what you find when you make measurements. Here's the periodic table, so I want to get realistic here. We're going to concentrate on uranium. This is really the active element in the things we want to talk about. But the compounds that I'm going to talk about are scandium and yttrium, palladium 3, and in those cases one will substitute uranium for either yttrium or scandium. And then I'll talk about uranium, ruthenium 2, silicon 2, and here we'll look at substitutions where you put in rhodium, iridium, osmium, or technetium or rhenium for ruthenium, and actually I'm going to concentrate on the case of rhenium. It turns out that technetium and rhenium are in the same column of the periodic table in transition series, and they actually both give rise to the same general effects when you substitute for ruthenium, so you're really dealing with a valence situation. And the same can be said for scandium, yttrium, palladium 3. When you substitute uranium, you actually generate the same physics and the same phase diagram. So the chemical aspects really come through very strongly in these materials. All right, so anyway, this is the uranium, has the radon filled shell, and the configuration in the atom 5F3 60 17S2. And in materials that you prepare, in general it can be either, well, one hopes that it would be trivalent or tetravalent, but for the reasons that I indicated here, if you actually calculate the effective moment for these two configurations, the effective moment is about the same. So it's very difficult to tell which of these configurations you have. Moreover, the f orbitals are rather extend out rather far in space, and so for that reason you can't really tell it from the lattice parameter. So one of the puzzles in most uranium compounds is, you know, what is identifying the actual uranium valence, and of course it need not be 3+ or 4+, it could be something in between. However, there are a few examples where you can identify the F electron configuration, and there are cases where you can see crystal electric field effects, although there aren't very many. And for example, if you had uranium 4+ in a cubic crystal electric field, it would split up into a gamma 1 singlet, a gamma 3 non-magnetic doublet, a gamma 4 and gamma 5 triplets, and you would get a set of energy levels. And in fact, for uranium palladium 3, such a thing does exist, and I've indicated here a particularly interesting energy level scheme that actually has a gamma 3 non-magnetic doublet ground state that carries a quadrupole moment. And this sort of configuration could, in principle, give rise to a quadrupolar Tondo effect. Now, however, no one's ever proven that such a thing exists, in spite of how hard they and we have tried, but this would be a very interesting situation if you could find it in nature. Yeah?
The quadrupole has been found.
Oh, yeah.
The quadrupole order ring,
yes.
Along with the spin order,
yes,
ring.
Right.
In recent years, it was
correct.
Through the force to keep the human.
Right.
Is this
exactly.
An experimental phase armor? I mean, the level seems to be experimental.
No, this is just a schematic possibility.
I mean, uranium palladium 3 is known, right?
Yeah, right. No, it actually has a gamma 3 ground state.
On which side? The cubic side or the?
I don't know. It's not cubic. But anyway.
That's right.
I don't know. Yeah.
Could you be a bit more explicit?
Pardon?
What did you say?
Oh. Uranium palladium 3 has a different structure.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about a cubic structure, in which case you would get these energy levels.
Okay.
Uranium palladium 3 is not cubic, it's more complicated, but nonetheless people have seen quadrupolar ordering. And
so how do they see this, the quadrupolar
ordering?
Synchrotron in Grenoble.
You can either do that or you can infer it from neutron diffraction, if you say apply a magnetic field and induce a moment when the quadrupoles align, and it can be done that way.
There's two phase transitions with the system, very, very small in terms of the new model.
But what motivated our own work on these compounds I mentioned was the fact that you can see these crystal electric field effects in uranium palladium 3, but I'll come to that in a moment. Okay, so. In uranium-based systems, the really interesting physics, correlated electron physics, comes about because of the hybridization between the localized 5F states and the conduction electron states. So if you think about the hybridization strength, then you can kind of schematically imagine that if it's weak, you would get ionic behavior. The 5F occupation number would be integral. If it's moderate, you could get Kondo favor behavior. The occupation number would be, say, close to integral. If it's appreciable, you could get valence fluctuations where you'd have a non-integral average occupation of the 5F shell. And then, of course, if it's strong, then you could generate F bands. Now, of course, this is all very qualitative, but I'm going to kind of adopt the view in my discussion that we have moderate hybridization and Kondo behavior just to motivate the discussion that I want to have. Okay, so. When I think about heavy fermion F electron materials, the easiest way to think about them for me, although I would prefer to think about them in terms of valence fluctuations, I think about them mostly in terms of the Kondo effect. And the underlying physics then, again, can be traced to this hybridization. And you could imagine generating an antiferromagnetic exchange interaction between, say, some effective spin on the uranium side and the spins of the conduction electron, where the exchange interaction parameter J is given by this expression right here, And so this would depend upon the square of this matrix element that admixes attenuant states and localized F states. And then also on the energy separating the F level and the Fermi level. And this is the thing that you can tune through substitutions if you're doing the types of experiments that I want to talk about. And so you can then imagine tuning this interaction and then changing the parameters that determine the physics. So if we had a Kondo lattice consisting of uranium ions, then although that problem has not been solved in a very, how can I say, precise manner, I think people generally believe that you can still think about a Kondo temperature that's related to the Fermi energy and an exponential involving the density states at the Fermi level and this parameter J, and that this is related to some temperature we'll call T star, which is more or less an effective Fermi temperature. So if the temperature is much larger than T star, you get local moment behavior, and indeed that's what's observed, and you get a Curie-Weiss law, where the T star here appears in the denominator and can be estimated, and you get Kondo scattering, which is manifested in this log T behavior, which sometimes you can actually separate out. When the temperature is much lower than T star, you form presumably some sort of many-body singlet, which I've schematically indicated here, and you can arrive at a non-magnetic heavy Fermi liquid, where the susceptibility approaches a constant value proportional to the effective mass inversely proportional to T star. Similarly, the electronic specific heat coefficient approaches a constant. And then, as you know, the ratio of these two things is of the order of one. This is the Wilson-Sommerfeld ratio. And I think one of the most remarkable things is in this situation, in contrast to normal metals, where you have very high Fermi temperatures, this electron-electron scattering contribution, this AT contribution, is very pronounced, and you can pick out this pre-factor A, and that is proportional to roughly gamma squared. And as you know, the heavy Fermi liquid is unstable to superconductivity and magnetic order, and the whole thing gives rise to some really rich physics. Okay, now one of these things is heavy fermion superconductivity, and I'm actually not going to talk about this, but there are cases where, you know, you have triplet, it's believed that you have triplet superconductivity or singlet superconductivity, and I think uranium platinum 3 is a candidate for triplet superconductivity, and praseodymium, osmium, antimonide, a compound we've been investigating for the last several years, also appears to be one of the leading candidates for triplet superconductivity. And then I'm sure you've talked about, discussed this before, and you'll discuss it later on, but sometimes this superconductivity occurs near a quantum critical point at some composition of pressure where the magnetic ordering is tuned to zero or suppressed. Okay, so the thing that I'm interested in discussing is non-Fermi liquid behavior, and this has been found, as you know, in compounds containing uranium, cerium, and ytterbium. I don't think there are any other F electron species that are known to yet to give rise to it. And it was first found in a number of chemically substituted materials starting in the early 90s. And then more recently in stoichiometric materials at zero pressure and at pressures, finite pressure. And I think the center of interest at the moment is in these materials. Some of them are very pure and have very low residual resistivity. But I think I think of them as sort of a large class of materials, irrespective of whether they're chemically substituted or stoichiometric, because they seem to have very similar behavior, weak power law or logarithmic divergences in temperature, at low temperature, lower than some characteristic temperature, and you invariably find a power law resistivity where N is, I think, usually close to 1, but can be between 1 and 1.5. And this can be either positive or negative. So in some cases, as you lower the temperature, you get a Kondo-like linear divergence. In other cases, you get a decrease, and sometimes you find this in the same general class of materials. And then you get a specific heat divided by temperature that diverges logarithmically most of the time, although you can often also described this as a weak power law. And then the susceptibility is more complicated because I think susceptibility is harder to analyze. And these various types of behavior have been observed. And then I think the most spectacular result is this Meg-Oakert descaling of the imaginary part of the dynamical susceptibility. So basically you have this lower energy scale than a Fermi liquid that gives rise to these interesting properties.
And that's generic? Yeah. Or does that occur only at special points in the phase diagram?
Well, usually, well, okay. There are some, I was going to come to that next. Let me come to that next. Because I think I've forgotten what graphs I have in here. This PowerPoint is too mysterious for me. Okay, here we go. So I think this answers my view of your question, or my view of the answer to your question. And there are experiments that suggest there are two routes to non-Fermi liquid behavior. Not a lot of cases, but some cases seem to be traceable to single ion physics. And most of the cases, I would say, are associated with interionic interactions. And so this is really an experimental statement. And then, of course, there have been a number of models that have been suggested to apply to these situations. There are at least two single ion models, the multi-channel Kondo effect and also the single channel Kondo effect with disorder. So you get a distribution of Kondo temperatures. And if you're at a given temperature, then some ions will look non-magnetic, others will appear to be magnetic, and this can kind of give you non-Fermi liquid-like behavior. Then you have interacting ion models, fluctuations of an order parameter above a second order phase transition at zero Kelvin, and I think this is what most people are working on. And then the Griffith phase scenario, where you have the interplay between disorder and competing Kondo and RKKY interactions. And then there are some other ones. Stefan Sulo has some ideas about disorder and metal insulator transitions. And so there may be a few other cases, but I think these are the ones that people mostly work on. So I don't know, is that true to you? Have in mind? Okay, so now let me talk about these experiments. So we'll talk about the M uranium palladium 3 system, where M can be yttrium or scandium. And as I mentioned, this was the first system in which these types of behavior were found. And we did a fairly detailed study of the resistivity, specific heat, and magnetization as a function of temperature and field over a fairly large concentration range, and interpreted our experiments in terms of the quadrupolar Kondo effect. At that time, well, I'll come back to that in a moment, that explained at least several of the observations that we made. Now, also, Andraka and Svelik studied a sample with this composition and did a similar set of measurements, and they interpreted their results in terms of order parameter fluctuations associated with a magnetic transition suppressed to zero Kelvin. So these were quite very different interpretations of basically the same data or same types of data. And I think that and I certainly wouldn't suggest that the quadrupolar Kondo effect is necessarily at work here, but I do think that there's some interplay between some sort of Kondo effect and magnetic interactions and disorder that give rise to this non-Fermi liquid behavior.
I think these must have been amongst the very first papers to discuss the concept of non-Fermi liquid behavior in
epileptic electrons. That's correct. Yeah. Of course, it had been discussed a lot in one-dimensional systems and then Cooper
and other in the previous 3-4 years.
And it had also been speculated, you know, for uranium beryllium 13. Daniel Cox had some ideas, but I don't think the real signatures. There were no real signatures at that time. Okay, so anyway, extensive investigations have been made in the meantime by many groups, including our own, and I think the situation is much more complex. In spite of a lot of inelastic neutron scattering studies, the uranium 4 plus energy level scheme is not yet established, and it's a long story I don't want to go into. And then also there are fluctuations in the uranium concentration on a 10 micron scale that was first pointed out by Stefan Sulo and John Mydosh and their co-workers, And we have certainly confirmed that this is the case. So in recent years, we've looked at a similar system, scandium uranium plating 3. This has basically the same type of non-Fermi liquid behavior, which I'll show you, and a more homogeneous distribution of uranium. And this is the one where these recent inelastic neutron scattering studies have revealed the mega over T scaling of the of chi double pi. Okay. So here's the phase diagram. This isn't the original one we reported on back in 91, so we've updated it as we've learned more. But basically, this is temperature versus uranium concentration. And here's the hexagonal nickel three titanium structure for uranium platinum 3, which is interesting in its own right, and was what John was mentioning, and Mike. We're interested in what happens over here, and what you see is that there's an antiferromagnetic order occurs in this region, long-range antiferromagnetic order, confirmed by neutron scattering. And here you get a thin glass region over here, and this is the conga temperature divided by 10, and it drops off nearly exponentially as you increase the uranium concentration. And so you get a conga effect in this region right here, and at low temperatures you have non-Fermi liquid behavior. So you have a whole bunch of things going on here.
And that conga temperature was determined from some feature in its resistivity?
Or? Yeah, I'll show you that next.
So in the low X region you don't get a heavy Fermi liquid? I thought
the impurities then.
Because of the impurities.
Yeah. Well, I mean you do, yeah, well, okay, a little more complicated. I mean, this isn't an ordered compound. If you were, for example, to take the electronic specific heat coefficient and divide it by the uranium concentration, you'll find numbers that are of the order of a joule per mole Kelvin square. So in that sense, it is a heavy fermion system, but it arises at least in part from some single ion physics. It's like a material with a low conga temperature. If you were to take the specific heat and divide it through by the concentration, you would get very high local gammas, if you want to think about it.
But it's not a Fermi liquid because of the disorder, is
it? Well, it's not a Fermi liquid. And I don't know why. I'm not. Yeah. Let me go a little bit further. Excuse me.
What about virtual fans? Suppose simply in this combo non-Fermi liquid?
Pressure dependence?
Temperature dependence of the resistivity.
I'll show you. Okay, so we're gonna first do conga effect, and then we'll talk about non-Fermi liquids. So this is basically a rho versus T for uranium, yttrium uranium platinum 3. And so here are concentrations starting x equals 0 to 0.5. And for x equal 0.1 and 0.2, you see typical conga behavior, these at high temperatures. For 0.3 to 0.5, you see features at low temperatures that are due to either antiferromagnetic ordering or spin glass freezing. If you then subtract off this background, although it's really negligible, you can then plot the resistivity divided by its zero temperature value versus the log of TK of the temperature, and then you find regions at high temperature that are linear in log T, at least within our, I mean, we haven't gone above room temperature, so we're restricted to this temperature range. But you can see that these start to bend over at lower temperatures, and we take as a criterion, when this ratio is equal to 0.8, we define this as the conga temperature, and you can see that this changes as you change the composition. Okay? And so if you now plot the conga temperature versus X, then it drops off as you increase X. Okay? And this can be traced to a Fermi level tuning effect. Uranium is tetravalent, yttrium is trivalent. As you put in uranium, you put in electrons, the Fermi level rises, the F level sinks into the Fermi C, and if you think about this exchange interaction primer that I wrote down, it should then decrease the farther the energy between the F level and the Fermi level. And in fact, we've even confirmed this with photoemission studies. Okay? And this is more or less what you do when you do condo physics, at least a la the 50s and 60s.
Can you fit the low temperature rho with the T squared thing?
You cannot. They'll come in. You cannot.
Minus? There's no.
We're going to come to it now.
Yeah, we're going to come to that almost next. Okay, so now we come to the susceptibility. Again, in condo lore, if you take the high temperature, this is inverse susceptibility versus temperature for concentrations across the whole range. But at high temperatures, you see that you can fit the data to the Curie-Weiss law. And in condo lore, the Curie-Weiss temperature is of the order of 3 to 4 times TK, and it's negative. And so from this, you can extract TK from the Curie-Weiss temperature. And here I've just plotted the Curie-Weiss temperature without doing any renormalization, normalization, I should say. And you can see then that this decreases as you increase X, just like the condo temperature did that you inferred from the electrical resistivity. And then the magnetic moment here is roughly constant, close to 3-4 magnetons.
Why is the error bar so weak as a magnetic
moment? I'm sorry.
This error bars are so weak as a magnetic moment. Because looking at these plots,
well, the scale is quite spread out.
Yeah, this is 2.8 to 3.4, so it's really not so bad. I mean, it's a matter of how well you can fit these data straight lines. I think that's pretty good.
Excellent.
Okay, so anyway, this is what you'd expect if you just did condo physics. Okay, now we come to what happens at low temperatures, which is still condo physics, but some different kind of condo physics, plus maybe something else. But here, what we've done is we've taken the resistivity normalized to its zero temperature value, and we have 1 minus that, versus temperature on a log-log plot. And so the slope here will give you the exponent if the data are described by this formula right here. And the intercept will give you the free factor, delta rho of 0. And what we find is from temperatures of the order of 100 millikelvin up to, I think, around 20 Kelvin, even higher, that this is consistent with a exponent of 1.1, which I would say is 1. So this is essentially a linear resistivity, or a nearly linear resistivity. And then when you look at the specific heat divided by temperature and plot it versus log T, this is just the phonons and crystal field Schottky anomalies at high temperatures, which you cannot accurately subtract. But anyway, at lower temperatures, you find this logarithmic divergence. And then when you go down to, say, around 100 millikelvin, you see this actually turns up. And it's very similar to what people have been discussing for ytterbium, rhodium-2, silicon-2, and other stoichiometric compounds, which people have been investigating recently. Now, our interpretation of this in the old days was that if this was a quadrupolar, a two-channel spin 1/2 quadrupolar condo effect, there should be a residual entropy of R over 2 log 2 at low temperatures. And if you now were to have some interaction that would lift the degeneracy of this doublet ground state, then you could actually remove that entropy, and then the specific heat would have to make some sort of huge excursion upwards in order to release that entropy that otherwise would exist at this temperature. Now, I don't know if other quantum critical models have that feature in them, but that's one of the interesting aspects of the two-channel spin 1/2 condo effect.
Can you show them? Is it residual entropy?
It's consistent. It's consistent. I'd have to sit down, and I don't think I'm prepared to do it right now, but if you compare these low concentration data with higher concentrations where you actually have Schottky anomalies and you can estimate the entropy, these things are consistent with a residual entropy of R2 log 2.
Is there a spin glass freezing somewhere here?
Yes. We'll come to that in a moment.
But at this concentration, or are we passing?
At this concentration, yeah. It's right next to it.
So we need a little bit more to get the spin glass.
Exactly.
So you'd say the freezing temperature is...
Okay. Let me just mention, this is the susceptibility. It actually is consistent with T^1/2 behavior. This was not one of the other predictions of the quadrupolar condo effect. In fact, these two predictions were what, and the fact that these things scale with concentration led us to conclude that this might be an example of the quadrupolar condo effect. At that time, no one had predicted what the resistivity to do, and the best guess was it would be linear. When it was calculated, it turned out to be t to the 1/2. That's what the calculation was.
Did you estimate the cubic exponent of the specific cubic Taylor?
Oh, you mean?
Yes, turn.
No, did not. Yeah. That's an interesting question. Yes.
So when you say these exponents were expected from quadrupolar condo, this is assuming you're sitting at the concentration of the quantum critical point.
No, the quadrupolar condo effect is a single ion model.
Yeah, so it's any, okay.
And so, in principle, you could have non-Fermi liquid behavior all the way across the phase diagram, and let me just, John will come back to your question if I can remember it, the spin glass question. But let me now just go to...
Sorry, this is the dilute system.
It's dilute. I mean, it's not...
No. So that T linear resistivity is an open mystery, yeah?
Open mystery.
Why don't you comment on the negative slope?
Beg your pardon?
It's not really now.
It's a minus slope.
The plot is... This is 1 minus the reduced resistivity versus temperature. So this is increasing as you lower the temperature, but it's linear instead of saturating like T squared.
The point is it means that the inelastic scattering developing at high temperature aren't consistent with the first efforts to model the
polar. Now, I'll come back to this T to the 1/2 thing in a moment, because there's another twist that I'll come to. But anyway, let me just show you here. This now is, that was x equals 0.2, this is 0.1. The problem with these experiments is that as you lower the concentration, the condo temperature goes up. That means that the slope of these features decreases. Also, you go to a lower concentration, so the signal you're trying to measure becomes reduced very rapidly. But nonetheless, if you go to 0.1, you can find a resistivity that now has n equal 1.4. And again, you see this logarithmic divergence, although it's much attenuated, and this little upturn, and then this is consistent.
Now you're far away from the spin glass.
Yes, now we've gone halfway in concentration from it toward zero.
Suppose hypothetically you went to even a lower concentration of uranium, would you ever come out with a single ion pure condo effect? That means the resistivity would actually be a 1 minus t squared.
Well, it's hard to establish because your signal
goes away.
I mean, because TK is going way up. And so remember, the slope of these things is proportional to 1 over TK. And also the number of scattering centers goes down.
It might also be that you are seeing the single ion behavior, and the single ion behavior is not orthodox.
Now, there's another system that I...
For uranium.
Well, in this particular system, the two-channel scenario could work, because you've got a cubic lattice.
You have a cubic lattice.
Mm-hmm. And you can have a quadrupolar degenerate ground state, in principle.
In principle. Mm-hmm. And from the neutrons, you know, it's not out of the question, but that's a complicated story that I don't want to get into yet.
You know, Dr. Sen, you see the single ion behavior, or how dilute is this?
Well, it's not very dilute, but you know, that's sort of a qualitative statement, because copper manganese is a classic condo system, and at the parts per million level, you can find spin glass ordering at millikelvin temperatures. So it really depends upon what temperature you're at when you make such a statement.
Did you ever see any other measurement other than specific heat, any signature of deviation, you know, some low temperature changeover in behavior correlated with the 0.2 Kelvin or whatever that you see in...
No, we never have. We have nothing. Well, let me take that back. I'll come to this in a moment.
Okay.
There's another thing that I thought will come to. Okay, now, John, getting back to the spin glass. So this is 0.1. 0.2 I just talked about. So let's see if I can go backwards here to the phase diagram. So 0.2 is right here. And so this is right next to the spin glass freezing temperature being suppressed.
That is amazing if you put it in contrast with the copper manganese that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. Almost infinitesimal concentrations, give you a spin glass there, whereas here, you have to go up to a whacking 20% in a spin glass.
How do you,
what
is the indication of the glass?
No, copper manganese is milli kelvin. Mm-hmm. So you always have local moments that eventually are always going to form the wind glass space. Here you have pretty high tidal temperatures.
Right. Sure. So but it's amazing.
What is the indication? Oh, okay, the stained glass, we take this as difference in zero field cooling and field cooling measurements of its susceptibility, also by looking at fine magnetic field and looking at the decay of the magnetization. You get finite decays in this region and no decay in this region right here, no relaxation. So I don't want to, you know, again, I'm not an expert on stained glasses, but it certainly gives some glassiness that you can detect through magnetic measure.
But it can be just more complicated state, not just...
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure. I mean, it could be, maybe there's a ferromagnetic component in there. I mean, it could be something very exotic, but it, at this level, it looks like a glass. Okay, so let me now... Okay, this is something I'm not prepared to discuss very much, but this is going way back. Anyway, this is work we did with... Stuart Brown and one of his students, John McCartan. And this is thermoelectric power, which I think is a very interesting tool to try to study quantum criticality that hasn't been used very much, and we want to mount an effort to do more of this. But anyway, this is a little bit hard to read, but this is the pure material right here. So this is yttrium platinum 3. Then as you add uranium, you find that the thermal power actually develops this very large peak, and then it crosses over and becomes negative again. And all of this happens right around x equal 0.2, which is the quantum critical point on that figure. And then the resistivity divided by the concentration also exhibits a precipitous drop there. So this certainly points in the direction that there's some kind of Fermi surface or electronic structure change, perhaps associated with this special point. Yeah.
The very top one.
Yeah. So this is pure yttrium uranium platinum. I'm sorry, pure yttrium platinum 3, and then this is 0.03. Is this? Let's see. I'm figuring this out myself.
Square. Which square?
That one. Yeah. I think it's this one here. And then at 0.1, you get the pluses, and 0.2, the triangles, and then it drops down. Yeah. So there's a rather profound change, yes.
So does the thermopower over temperature track the specific heat coefficient that you were showing, the temperature dependence?
The electronic specific heat coefficient?
Yeah, or? Just the one that you showed before, the temperature dependence.
I don't know. I don't know quite what to think of this. I mean, thermal power, again, is a kind of a complicated thing, at least in the simplest views. It depends upon, you know, derivatives of the density of states, and I don't know, there are other experts probably here that could be, maybe John, you know. I mean, giant thermal power is seen in lots of condo systems, and often there's a peak near the condo temperature. Is that what you're asking?
No, for example, in cerium, copper, gold,
okay,
where you have this logarithm in your specific heat coefficient.
Oh, yeah.
The thermal power over temperature tracks it.
Okay, okay. I don't know. That's an interesting point. I'd like to talk to you about that. Okay, so I just wanted to point that out. And now, let me come to the scandium-based system. So here's the phase diagram for yttrium uranium platinum 3. Remember, this suffered from some, I would say, not serious metallurgical problems, but you do form these little dendrites, and there's some fluctuations in the uranium composition. So we went to the scandium-based system in order to see what would happen there. And here the metallurgy is quite good. And I think that's because the atomic radii are more close to each other. But basically what you find is the same general type of phase diagram, although we haven't studied it in quite so much detail as shown at least in the previous slide. But again, you see the decrease of the condo temperature, thin glass region over here, and antiferromagnetic order.
Is that times, it's over 20 now?
No, this is over 20. So this has higher condo temperatures. And now if you compare, say, what happens at their respective stained glass freezing, or whatever you call them, quantum critical points, then you find that the resistivity is nearly linear for each of them. Here I've just plotted it on a linear plot. and so you see it growing linearly, not saturating like t-squared. They both have this logarithmic divergence of the of C over T, but we haven't here measured it to a low temperature as shown in the previous slide. And also you find this T to the 1/2 susceptibility. And so they really behave quite similarly, and I would say that it appears as if this non-thermoliquid behavior, okay, perhaps there is a single ion physics component, but it certainly seems like it's somehow associated with this spin glass freezing temperature vanishing.
Let me ask you one question. Yeah. What is the and is it existing temperature?
The antiferromagnetism?
Yeah.
Okay, where it's been studied by neutrons, it's a commensurate structure. And these are measurements on polycrystals, so the moment direction isn't known, but it's it's a simple antiferromagnetic structure, so it kind of alternates.
So it's uranium.
It's uranium. Yeah.
How can we mention if it exists something?
Well, what happens, I mean, if the uranium ions order in a commensurate structure, but some ions don't order because they're occupied by scandium or yttrium. Okay.
The percolation.
Yeah.
Yes. For the resistivity, you would see it go up at some point, no? With the temperature, there should be temperature when it starts to go up again.
Is it going
to go up?
Yeah. Okay. This is also an enormous species theory. I have to point that out. This is 300 to 400 micro-ohm centimeters, and so this thing is linear down here, and then at higher temperatures, it just keeps going down. And then bends over and becomes logarithmic in temperature. So the point is, it never.
You mean the resistivity never increases with temperature?
No, well, not at these concentrations. I mean, if you go to low enough uranium concentrations, it will. But remember, these resistivities are enormous, and the lattice contribution is minuscule compared to this.
So you're much above the Kerrigan limit. Almost insulating somehow.
That's an interesting issue.
The mean free path is much less than lattice phase.
Yes.
The diagram looks like the residual resistance is peaking up here.
Even
if you are.
Do you want to find the real resistance?
Yes, it's very small. Which is another weird thing. Okay, so let me continue. Now here's some work we did a few years ago, and here's what happens when you look at the scandium base system at lower temperatures. This is the resistivity, and so now here's x equal 0.2. For this one, the quantum critical point's about 0.3. And what you find is that here the exponent's 1.3. Now these are measurements down to about 100 millikelvin, and so as you go up in x, this is 1.4, so roughly say 1.3 to 1.4 at lower concentrations. Higher concentrations drops down to 0.8, and then when you get near the quantum critical point, it actually becomes T to the 1/2, the consistent with T to the 1/2, which is actually the prediction of the quadrupolar Kondo effect, although I'm not trying to claim that that's happening.
So T 1/2 is also
yes.
T 1/2 is also the conclusion from relocalization in 3D?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the point. You've got magnetic resistance, they don't see anything.
Magnetic resistance is very weak.
Oh,
yeah. I'll have to look back at this particular case, but I mean, one thing we tried to do is see if we could make this crossover to T squared, and not very much happens in the magnetic field. So I'll have to look that up. Okay, and then you see what happens to the specific heat again. At higher concentrations, you get stained glass freezing, so the specific heat reflects that. Then right around where you think the quantum critical point is, you get a linear C over T in log T. Okay. And again, this kind of behavior persists as you move away from the quantum critical point towards the fermion.
So the specific heat is not that huge compared to the resistance. The coefficient is not
Let's see. This is
reasonably big.
Yeah. So this is only Okay, yeah, so this is a few hundred millijoules per mole concentration. Pretty big, but it could be bigger. And also, the slope scale with concentration, that's another thing that causes to think in terms of Kondo effects. Okay, so let me continue on. So this is the most recent work. This was done with Peng Cheng Dai and his student, Wilson. And so this is measurements of the imaginary part of the dynamical susceptibility derived from neutron scattering measurements on a 20-gram sample, I think it was. And they looked at several different compositions, but this one is close to where the quantum critical point should be. And so here what you find is that chi double prime times t to the 1/5 versus omega over t gives you this scaling behavior right here. There is no Q dependence, suggesting there's no, at least no evidence for correlations between the uranium ions. And so you seem to have some single impurity of scaling that appears to be associated with this spin glass transition suppressed to 0 Kelvin. And what Dai did, he also put in here this line right here, which is the functional form suggested in this paper by C. I think Kevin, Kevin was involved in this work that was in this Nature paper. And this, of course, is proposed for an antiferromagnetic quantum critical point, as I recall. So it certainly, you know, is consistent with it at higher energies and deviates at lower energies. But my point.
You try the same kind of scaling curve that you get with uranium, copper, palladium, right?
Yeah, doesn't work. Yeah. So this is 1/5 seems to be the answer for this one.
No, no. I mean with the 1/5. Yeah. I mean, the same kind of scaling curve.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh no. Oh, I. You mean this one?
Well, I mean that's
this functional. Yeah.
The scaling form that you're using with uranium, copper, palladium.
Well, I think Peng Cheng tried that. I think that didn't work. Let's see here. Okay, let me just then go on and say that. So this, I think, is, to my knowledge, the third example where you find this type of scaling. And so the first one was uranium, copper, palladium. And this is at least the when x equals 1, you're near an antiferromagnetic quantum critical point. For 1.5, you might be near a spin glass quantum critical point. In this case, alpha was equal to 1/3. And then, this is from Megan's measurements, and then from Almut Schroeder's work on cerium copper gold, I think alpha was equal to 0.75, and in this case it's equal to 0.2 or 1.3.
Do you see that exponent in the benchtop uniform susceptibility?
I have those data in my computer, and I have to look at this again. I wanted to look at that.
If you believe it's pervasive over Q space, you should see the Q for 0.
Yeah. I think it's not inconsistent. But I'll look at that, but I didn't have a chance to prepare it.
Are there any observations of resistivity?
For the what?
Resistivity measured in plane and out of plane size. Is there any growth or isotropic? Resistivity,
This is cubic. It's a cubic material.
So it's isotropic.
It's isotropic. Yeah. Now, these are not single crystals, however, which is another interesting thing. You can grow single crystals in the antiferromagnetic medium, but you cannot grow them, at least as this is our experience. When you're in the non-magnetic region, which is another mystery. It's almost like Coup phase, where you have some kind of inhomogeneities and things. Okay, so at any rate, that probably took a long time. So I want to now just forget about hidden order and all these other things and just move quickly. When did we start?
We started about 12:45, probably.
Okay, so.
So, well, you've certainly got another.
Okay, so let me, I mean, I think John's probably talked a lot about uranium within 2-silicon-2, so let me just kind of jump into that now, and I'll try to move through some things without spending too much time on it. So let me just try to motivate this. So this study was to look at non-Fermi liquid behavior in the vicinity of a ferromagnetic quantum critical point, and back in the 80s, and late 80s, we were looking at various substitutions for ruthenium in uranium-ruthenium-2-silicon-2. And this was motivated by the work that we did suggesting that some sort of charge or spin density wave was probably responsible for the large specific heat in this compound. At least that was our view at the time. And so this was just part of a study in which we wanted to examine this. And what we found is that substitution of these various elements depressed the nail temperature and PC. And in the course of this, we studied technetium and rhenium substitutions at higher concentrations. And we found that you actually entered into a ferromagnetic region that looked like some sort of itinerant ferromagnet. And it turns out that technetium and rhenium are in the same column. As I mentioned earlier, the ferromagnetism extends over a large range of X values. You find a maximum in the Curie temperature, and that's accompanied by a maximum in the saturation moment and gamma, the electronic specific heat coefficient, at nearly the same value of X. And also, the other thing is you find no anomalies in the specific heat or the resistivity due to the ferromagnetism near the Curie temperature. So this, when we were doing this work, this was long before the recent interest in zirconium zinc 2, but two of the weak itinerant ferromagnets, zirconium zinc 2 and scandium 3 indium, are also compounds where if you make a material in a conventional way, you do not see signatures in the specific heat or the resistivity when they become ferromagnetic, and you invariably have to determine this from some sort of magnetic measurement, usually an error plot. Now, in recently, of course, people have made very high purity single crystals of zirconium zinc 2. I think there you do see some features in low fields.
Mark, yeah. In this compound, is it a second-order transition?
It looks like that, but again, I'll show you the data shortly. Okay, so anyway, now let me just say about how we studied the ferromagnetism. We did magnetization measurements and analyzed them in terms of a conventional Erret plot or a modified Erret plot if that was necessary. And so this is more or less the modified Erret plots that we just adopted as a phenomenological, well, it's more than phenomenological, but just our technique. And if it was a standard Erret plot, beta would be 1/2, gamma would be equal to 1. This would be a mean field result. And then you have these critical exponents, beta, gamma, and delta. They're defined by these relationships here, and this is all based upon this Erret-Noakes equation.
I'm slightly puzzled about this non-anomaly statement. I mean, for all we know, there's got to be something, right? So is it too weak to be measured, or what's going on?
I don't know. I mean, I can only say that there are these two weak ferromagnetic examples from the past where that's the case, and it's the case here. Now, we are making single crystals of these things, so maybe when we look at that in single crystals, it'll be different. But there's still, this is a disordered system. And
so the disordered background could be too high, or maybe inhomogeneities?
Yeah, it could be.
Well, what's TC? When you're measuring it, if it's very high, you won't be able to separate it from the disorder, the flow numbers, and everything else that's coming in.
But there should still be a singularity,
still
right?
A singularity, yes. Yeah.
Let me show you.
The scaling must be, so alpha should be related to these other exponents leading to the rate.
Okay, so let me go through. Let's see, what are we doing here? Okay, this is, you already know about uranium within two sources, right, John? Okay, so I'll just go through this quickly. So there's the resistivity and susceptibility, and this is the specific heat. This is the most striking feature. You get this jump, which John and Beers and others have been exploring in terms of this hidden order. And so at higher temperatures, you can describe this as gamma T plus beta T cubed. And so that's this dashed line right here. When you get this, what we thought was a charge spin density wave transition, you then form, this forms over part of the Fermi surface, and then you have something left here. And then looking at the ratios of, say, this gamma that you get from this curve, and we took this gamma right here, right before it becomes superconducting, then this corresponds to about 40% of the Fermi surface removed by the spinner charge density line. Okay, and then it becomes superconducting, so our view was that the superconductivity competes for the Fermi surface with the spinner charge density wave. And if you follow that through, you can you know, do high pressure measurements, and you find that the nail temperature goes up, the PC goes down. And so this is the nail temperature, or the hidden order transition temperature, and that's the superconducting critical temperature, and they behave oppositely because presumably you get more Fermi surface gapped by the density wave. And these are measurements which I think followed up some work that John and his co-workers did at zero pressure. Then we made use of this exponential, or this form involving an energy gap, to actually determine how the energy gap changed with pressure, again associated with this hidden order state, or whatever it is. Okay, so anyway, let me go on. So these are some substitutions we made, but let me go right to where I want to be. So here's rhodium, osmium, rhenium, and iridium substitutions for ruthenium into this compound. And so this is the, I don't know what to call this thing, hidden order phase. So here's the temperature of the hidden order phase, how it changes as you add, this case, rhodium, osmium, rhenium, and iridium. And then the superconducting critical temperature is shown here. That's how it behaves. So it refers to this scale, temperature scale, and the other one to the right-hand scale. And here's what happens for the rhenium and technetium substitutions. Technetium is very radioactive, so we only did a little bit of work with that. And then we abandoned that because rhenium did the same thing. The trouble with rhenium is it's very expensive. But anyway, what you find is, okay, this is the Curie temperature. So it peaks up here at X about 0.6. And then this is accompanied by a peak in the saturation moment, goes up to, you know, over 0.4 Bohr megatons. That's to be contrasted with the 0.02 of a Bohr megaton in pure uranium ruthenium to silicon 2. So it goes over into a large moment phase. Here's the effective moment, drops off, and this is gamma. It goes up to about 165 millijoules per mole Kelvin squared. So this is a ferromagnetic phase. It looks like it's an itinerant ferromagnet. Then if you, now let me show you this phase diagram. This is based upon measurements that I'll show you in a moment. So this is temperature versus concentration. And the resistivity can be described by this power law dependence. And N here is the exponent. And so it varies between 1 and 2 and does this sort of thing. And this is the Curie temperature. The closed symbols represent magnetization measurements, where you do an error plot analysis, as I indicated before. And these open symbols are Curie-Weiss temperatures. So they're close, but they're never really the same. But you can see they track each other. So this then is the ferromagnetic phase. And what we've been trying to do is find a quantum critical point here. And it certainly doesn't look like it goes into any first order transition or becomes anything special, but again, you can never rule that out. But anyway, it does look like a second order disappearance of this Curie temperature. And then here's the hidden order phase dropping off on the superconductivity. Okay, so what you see then is that here's the quantum critical point, and the the exponent here of the resistivity in this range drops down to value close to 1, but you can see that it's, you know, has a very broad dependence upon composition. And the non-Fermi liquid character of it, if I can say it that way, extends deep into the ferromagnetic state and out into the paramagnetic state. Okay, now let's look at the, well, this is magnetization. So this is m to the 1 over beta versus h over m to the 1 over gamma. So by choosing these critical exponents and doing some scaling analysis I won't go into, you can make these modified error plots. And the line that passes through the origin then represents the Curie temperature. And then this is the magnetization versus field. And it has this h to the 1 over delta dependence. And so by taking these data, you can see the delta changes. This is a log-log plot. So by extrapolating the zero temperature, you can get delta at zero temperature, and it behaves like this. And right at the quantum critical point, it equals 1.5, which is what Dietrich, I think you and Tom predicted. But the other exponents are different. Okay. And this is the resistivity. Again, this is a log-log plot. And the data at very low temperatures become very noisy because you're subtracting large numbers from each other to get small quantities. And we'll try to go back to this and do a better job. But anyway, these things are all consistent with exponents that are far from 2 in most cases. And so if you now look at the specific heat, here's the specific heat. You see again the logarithmic divergence or weak power law. You can describe it either way. So here's the logarithmic description. Those are the straight lines. And so you see that the slope changes. The largest slope occurs right at the quantum critical point, and then it drops off as you go into the ferromagnetic phase and as you go back this way into the paramagnetic phase. And of course, eventually, you'll be back into the hidden order and superconducting phases here. And then if you put this all, and this is the slope, C0, that's the slope, and you see it goes through this. So if you now put this all together, then you have this phase diagram. So here's the quantum critical point. And so here you have the maximum deviation of the resistivity from 2 towards 1. And then the largest slope of the logarithmic divergence of C over T occurs right at that point. And I won't say, you can think about this in various ways. So I won't really go into any plausible pictures on it. I mean, I think this is something that one needs to understand, and we need to do more experiments. But I think that, this is just another example of behavior that seemed to me to be very, very prevalent in all kinds of situations, and that there are various repeating things, like a resistivity that's nearly linear, logarithmic divergence of C over T, and sometimes this can be extended in composition away from any observable quantum critical point, and it can happen in stoichiometric materials and in disordered materials. And so I guess from an experimentalist point of view, I kind of feel that there's some general principles here that encompass all these cases, and that it's our job to try to figure it out. So anyway, thank you. I'll stop there.
I'd like you to comment and say the generality of this observation that the resistivity slope can be negative. So you said it's observed in many compounds and sometimes in different classes. Mm-hmm. So I have two questions.
Yeah.
Can you just be a bit more specific? Is it observed in certain base compounds, for example? And is it observed also when the compound is extremely disordered?
Well, the system I'm thinking about, which I didn't talk about, maybe I can write on the board. Yeah. So I didn't really talk about this, but we did a lot of work on this uranium 1 minus X, MX, plating 2, aluminum 3. And this is, without the M here and the 1 minus X, this is a well-known heavy fermion compound. You studied this. So what we look at is M equals thorium, yttrium, and lanthanum. And so the kind of phase diagrams you get are very different, well, at least in some cases. Let's see here. How can I draw this? Okay, so this is for thorium substitution. So this is X, and the parent compound has a nail temperature of 15, 16, whatever, 14 Kelvin, and it becomes superconducting around 2 Kelvin. So, so this is, okay, so if I make thorium substitutions, so this is 1 and 0, what we find is that the male temperature doesn't change very much, the superconducting critical temperature doesn't change very much, but the features associated with them just disappear. They go away. And then when you get over here, you enter into a Kondo and Kondo non-Fermi liquid region, where the Kondo temperature is constant, it's about 20 Kelvin. And then the resistivity scales with concentration, and it actually, at low temperatures, has a 1.5x on it. So it, the resistivity at low temperatures is of order 1 minus T, say, over 2K to the 1.5.
So which is rho 0?
We have. Rho 0 is in there. So that's all the delta rho 0. Anyway, it's a large number. I don't remember exactly, but it's large. Okay. All right, so that resistivity then is one in which, at low, if I were to draw it then, so this is delta rho versus T, then it has this T, T to the 1/2 behavior, and it becomes logarithmic at log T at high temperatures. And you can do sort of the same kind of analysis I talked about.
So what's temperature at which it goes up again?
Well, again, this scattering is so large, in order to reach the part where it goes up again, that's going to come from phonons, you have to go to very low concentrations in order to see that part. Okay. So the more uranium you have in there, the more scattering, the higher the Kondo contribution. And so you have to go to low concentrations, but you could do it. But usually you don't see that.
Is it still a cubic material? Do you have a chance?
No, this is not cubic, this is hexagonal.
So then you have no chance to get the chemical reaction
effect? I don't think easily. I don't know, maybe.
Has anyone ever seen the quadrupolar Kondo effect?
Well, no one's ever established it, let's put it that way.
There's no firm experimental proof.
You should think of it like the search for alchemy or quantum computation. Though, like the Holy Grail, that on the way you learn lots of wonderful stuff.
Well, can I just finish on? Okay, now, and when you do yttrium substitutions, then the resistivity doesn't grow this way, it actually comes along and then goes down this way, and at low temperatures it's linear. It's linear from 100 millikelvin up to 10 Kelvin. I don't have the data in mind.
So the first one was thorium. And
yeah. So thorium, okay, now what yttrium does, yttrium gives you this. So you get rid of the antiferromagnetism and the superconductivity. You get a spin glass thing out here. And then your non-Fermi liquid behavior occurs over here. There's we can tell. And then when you put in lanthanum, you get a bigger spin glass thing that kind of comes out like that. But some of them have a resistivity that decreases as you lower the temperature, and it's non-Fermi liquid-like. And then this one has one where it increases as you lower the temperature. And so this is almost like a single ion situation. We can't find any quantum critical points in here, unless it's way over here. And then these we can identify at least spin glass freezing temperatures.
Do you have a similar formula based on cerium, which shows its negative
status quo? Oh, it goes down?
Yes.
Well, you always see negative when you have the loop. The loop concentration.
No, it's in the here, so it's...
Yeah, you always see it in the loop concentrations of cerium, lanthanum, copper 6.
Sure, but
here it's not diluted. Well, those are all typical Kondo systems.
Well, it's not concentrated either.
Yes. I mean, you can cross over from a Kondo-like situation to a one where you get a linear resistance.
Often you have to go to quite high concentrations before you see the... Resistivity drop over and start to come down as you go.
Yeah, I guess maybe we're talking about two different things. I thought you were referring to the phonons.
No, you tell me it's not really from the Kondo behavior of the system, so it's
I'm telling you that it looks Kondo-ish, except at low temperatures, it has a non-Fermi liquid exponent. And the specific heat has a logarithmic divergence of C over T all the way across this region. that scales with concentration. I can show you the data.
But I guess one of the interesting questions, although this might, supposing this is something to do with quadrupolar behavior in at least the cubic systems, it does raise the interesting question whether there might be some commonality between the physics. For example, when you approach a quantum critical point, you're going to be in a situation where additional channels are opened up for the Condor effect by the anti-fermion magnetism, as emphasized, for example, in Chandravarma's work of 2 weeks ago. And we can imagine that there may be situations where anti-fermion magnetism itself could induce phenomena where you've got more than one channel competing. And I think though you emphasize there are two routes to quantum critical or non-fermion liquid behavior, there may be some common features to those two.
And your ferromagnetic transition here, and you might have said it, but I might have missed it. What are the residual resistivities there? How does all of this stuff?
I was looking for that this morning, and they're large. I can't give you a number right now. I'll find it. But a few hundred microcentimeters.
You're saying this is an itinerant ferromagnet, which persists all the way down to this critical concentration around 0.3.
Correct.
Right? And you're using a criterion of the arrow charts
to
sort of establish both the temperature and the moments.
Yes.
But have you looked at the Rhodes-Wolfhart plots where you would do the Curie-Weiss moment against the saturation magnetization moment, which would really designate this?
It's not my computer. What's going on here? That again? It's amazing. I like it.
Is this
the
other workshop?
No.
Nobody knows.
Mm-hmm. Let's see.
It's lattice gauge theory.
It's that kind of gauge theory then.
This is a Fermi liquid.
This is more like a Fermi liquid than lattice gauge theory.
Where were we? I forgot.
Yeah, the establishment of the itinerant ferromagnet.
Oh, yeah. No, have not done that. But the reason I said itinerant is because the Curie temperature is tracked by gamma and the saturation moment. So that's what made me feel that it was itinerant. Kevin?
I asked earlier about this deviation from the logarithm and the CRT, whether it correlates or anything else. You said I must have missed it. You said there was going to be some other answer to that later, and I went over my head.
Okay. No, I think you asked me, was there any other property that showed a deviation in that temperature range from the behavior?
Yes. Yeah.
And so the specific heat had this upturn, and so what I came to and was alluding to was the resistivity going over to this Q, the 1/2 dependence. I have no idea whether there's a relationship or not, but
that happens at around the same temperature, or I thought that was a function of concentration, wasn't it?
Yeah, they're two different systems. That's true that on the specific heat in the yttrium based system, everything behaves rather uniformly. So that happens in all the cases where we've looked. We haven't looked in the scandium based system to low temperatures to see if that happens.
And the last graph you showed, the last graph you had With wishful thinking, you could see the hints of some upturn. If you went to another, down to 0.1 Kelvin, you might see something more.
I'd show you that, but I can't do that. Astronomical objects on there.
No, it's a space bar. Let's just use screen saver with the Mac.
Okay. All right. You were asking me about...
I was saying this with a bit of a... No, the very last figure you were showing, I was saying...
Oh, this one. Oh, sorry. I mean, I should go back to where we were.
Yes, where we were.
Oh, okay.
The very last slide you were showing.
I'm sorry, I'm going the wrong way again.
Hold on.
That one?
Was that your last slide? The last slide, that one's fine, yeah, I mean...
That one?
Yeah, either of those. I mean, you could see, if you look through rose-tinted glasses, you can sort of begin to see some sort of upturn at the lowest temperatures. But it's not so fully developed as in your earlier data.
Right, I mean, there we have... here we only went down to 0.5 Kelvin and we have to go into the dilution refrigerators to go lower, which we haven't done. It all just, you know, takes time. And there's so many possibilities. We have to choose the one we want to follow.
Are there any other examples of spin glass physics emerging in condo systems which have similar behavior?
Well, the one, I'll show you the data for this one. I didn't do a very good job of drawing it, but the data are rather spectacular. And, you know, in looking at these systems, we just sort of followed our intuition. But, you know, we usually find that when we destroy the antiferromagnetism, there's a spin glass thing sticking off to the side.
It's genetic.
And, you know.
Even the ferromagnet.
At right.
You should stick out if you go to low enough temperature.
Well, that's something we could look at.
Possibly look at. 0.3.
We want to do neutron scattering now in here and see what we can find at low temperatures.
But is there a suggestion that the unique power laws are associated with the point with the spin glass quantum condition?
It's suggestive. Put that way. We thought about that. The problem is that we can only make polycrystals, and for some reason we weren't able to make single crystals in the interesting composition range. But that was a little bit of a red experiment.
To follow up on Jim's last question, is there a first, looking at that data there, it's not clear that you see the logarithms or the non-physical behavior over the greatest range when you're above that x equals 0.3. Yeah. Do you in general see the resistivity showing of an anomalous power over a wider range near the spin glass temperature going to zero? Is that not true? It's more like a phase than a critical fan or whatever you normally call it.
Well, in the yttrium dope, this system that I was mentioning here, you know, I'm not doing it justice, but right near where the quantum critical point is, the resistivity in this disordered alloy that has 100 micro-ohm centimeter resistivity is linear from, you know, 20 Kelvin down to 100 millikelvin and probably below that. And the residual resistivity isn't a few micro-ohm centimeters, it's like 60. And so, I don't know, I think that's probably has something to do with what's going on around that quantum critical point. But, you know, the phase space is so big here, it's difficult to sometimes. I mean, I think one of the problems with this whole thing is that you have all these different aspects happening at the same time. And so, you know, the richness of these systems and these phase diagrams, you know, there's beauty in what you find. But there's so many things going on there to make that, it's difficult to extricate, you know, the elements out of which you want to draw some conclusions.
I suppose the notion might just be that there are two ways you could view this. One would be that you have a non-Fermi liquid phase developing from 0.3 up to 0.7 or 0.65. The other would be you've got a quantum critical point at 0.3, mm-hmm. and you just haven't gone down to low enough temperatures to see the results peel off from this and go over to some more conventional metallic behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any view on that? I mean, what do you think? Do you think you've got a whole phase here where this stuff goes on all the way down to low temperatures? Or do you think if you were to look at low temperature measurements, you'd see that this is the quantum critical region that does this mm-hmm. stuff at high temperatures, and down below you form a disordered Fermi liquid? Yeah.
If anything, it wants to turn up further, right? But if you look at very large
points, there aren't show any signs of saturating.
In fact, in the other system, comes up faster.
But okay, so you just suppose you were suggesting that upturn might be a quadrupolar condo. But why would you think that the formation of a spin glass would encourage the quadrupolar condo effect?
Just looking at the last point.
I agree, just looking at it.
between the spin glass is just a dilution problem of percolation, beyond the percolation.
Well, I mean, could it be signs of an interplay between the antiferromagnetic interaction driving you to something, I don't know, like a Varma-Jones fixed point where the things are balanced? He says just to bait you.
So, 13 years ago, I did a calculation for two impurities, two channel condo, and there we found, so in that, you know, it's always, that was the crudest attempt to try and put in RKKY, and there you find that antiferromagnetic RKKY is initially marginal, for very weak, very for close, large separations is marginal, but then it's a weakly relevant operator. So it could be that, in that case, the RKKY interaction only destabilizes multi-channel condo at a rather low temperature. So maybe, you know, if you would take that approach, then you would say what's happening at 0.1 Kelvin is the destabilization of the two-channel condo effect towards some correlate, more, you know, magnetically correlated state, or
would
big large state.
Wouldn't it destabilize it to a fermilitric, generically?
Well, so I guess if you have, you know, if it's from the point of view of two impurities, yes, but if you have competing interactions, then who knows what happens. I mean, there's destabilization of the local one-ion two-channel condo. What you go towards will depend on whether or not the interactions are frustrated or not. Presumably, they generically are frustrated here.
Okay, so
we need more measurements, more theory.
We need more theory. You don't understand the condo spin loss. Thanks very much, Brian.